weapons have existed as long as humankind. For millennia, they have determined the destiny of generations. Weapons bring suffering and death. They show what humans can inflict upon other humans. But they're also intended to keep the peace and pave new ways for technology. Ranged weapons. We will show how they have made history and shaped whole eras. Astonishing experiments will uncover the secret of their deadly efficiency. The mini ball, with its precision and penetrating power, is a real game changer in the 19th century.
It actually quite scared me.
The longbow even frightens medieval noblemen.
That's a piece of wood that transports arrows incredibly far.
And the Roman javelin incapacitates enemies with a simple trick.
I mean, if I was holding that, it would have reached the man behind.
Our first weapon, the pilum, the Roman javelin. According to ancient sources, it was the decisive weapon for the imperial legions. The history of the pilum dates back to the dawn of mankind. Humans have used spears for hunting for more than 400,000 years. It is the only way for them to kill dangerous large animals like bison, which were an essential part of the Neanderthals' diet. More than 40,000 years ago, a new species enters the territory of the Neanderthals. Homo sapiens, the modern man. The intruders carry wooden throwing spears that they use with great efficiency. About 10,000 years later, the Homo sapiens species has successfully outlived Neanderthals, probably thanks to a better hunting and combat technique.
It's a fact that a perfect hunting weapon, like a good throwing spear, for example, makes sure that the human brain, an organ which needs a considerable amount of protein, gets enough nutrients. A good hunting weapon is, of course, conducive to keeping the brain going.
A sensational finding in Germany from the 1990s, in Schöningen, Lower Saxony. Archaeologists discover 8 wooden javelins. They estimate they are at least 300,000 years old. About 10,000 years ago, groups of people started waging war against each other, making use of the weapons that had proven successful in hunting.
Ancient men developed means of hunting using spears and using throwing weapons and eventually bows. And as soon as they started fighting over territory, they used all of these weapons against other humans. You know, weapons are not designed purely for use against other people. They're designed for use against animals. They're hunting tools, and they then become divergent. They specialize as military or hunting weapons.
Ancient peoples further developed weaponry with great effort. Mike Lodes is a weapons historian. He finds spears particularly fascinating.
Spears come in all shapes and sizes, heavy ones and very light ones like this.
A normal throwing spear carries a decisive risk in battle. If it misses the target, it falls into the hands of the enemy, who can then throw it back at the attacker. From the 6th century BCE on, the rise of the Roman Empire marks the beginning of a new chapter in the history of javelins.
The most ingenious, the cleverest, the most designed spear ever made was the Roman pilum.
Roman soldiers used their spears in battles for more than 1,000 years. Like in the year 52 BCE, The Gauls desperately oppose their integration into the Roman Empire. They do everything in their power to defend Lutetia, which will later become Paris. Four Roman legions are attacking the Gauls. Difficult territory and the enemy's resistance are giving them a hard time. But in the end, Caesar's legionaries triumph. How did they use their miracle weapon, the pilum?
The way the Romans fight is very mechanical. They fight as a formation, they don't fight individually, whereas almost all the people they fight against fight as individuals. And the pilum is just one more way of making sure that these enthusiastic warriors coming towards you don't have shields.
The basic equipment of the Roman legionary back then consisted of protective mail, a short sword, and two pila. The length of a typical pilum, 2 meters. The weight, about 2 kilograms. The pilum looks strikingly different than other ancient spears. It has a long shaft with a broad square head. What is it for? What's its secret? Jens Christiansen is a blacksmith and passionate about historical techniques. He will try and manufacture a pilum the way the Romans did 2,000 years ago. First step, forge the head and the shaft from a blank. That needs to be at 1,000 degrees Celsius for the blacksmith to hammer it into the characteristic form.
Yeah, and as you can see, it really, something you have to put power
into. That's hard work.
Yeah.
I mean, I wasn't counting, but that was several hundred heavy power blows.
Yeah.
And what, just a third? But now, it's just grunt work.
Yeah, yeah.
We could use the power hammer.
Yeah, sure.
So let's do finish that. It off with that.
But even with a modern power hammer at 250 blows per minute, turning a blank into a pilum head takes several minutes. The elaborate manufacturing of one single pilum shows how highly advanced the techniques of ancient blacksmiths were. The Romans produced weapons on an industrial scale.
The industrial complex of the Roman arms industry was phenomenal. The average legion is 4,800, so round figures, 5,000 people in a legion. Roman legionary carried two of these over the shoulder, so that's 10,000 to supply a legion. Some battles had 20 legions, 200,000 of these. I mean, what an extraordinary achievement.
The Romans have standardized their manufacturing methods. This is how they are able to produce millions of pila throughout the centuries. The iron shaft of the pilum is fixed with two bolts on the heavy wooden stick. In the Battle of Lutetia, the pilum gives the Roman troops under Titus Labienus's command a decisive edge. Although the Gauls are armed with heavy shields, they cannot protect themselves from the penetration power of the Roman javelin.
Caesar tells us these front ranks were transfixed by our javelins, by our pila. In just a couple of salvos of pila, Labienus had managed to halt that storm of Gauls coming towards his men. Not only did he stop that charge, but by building a wall of dead and dying in front of his lines, he slowed any further charges, so that main tactic of the Gauls was now thwarted for the rest of the battle.
Denmark, a historical village museum. Mike Lodes and his team are preparing an experiment that will help them find out how the pilum actually performs when an attacker approaches at high speed.
What we've set up here is to imitate the charge of a barbarian against a Roman shield wall. So this is the barbarian shield. Carsten is the barbarian. So he is going to pull this sled as fast as you can, charging at me, and then see if it will penetrate this very sturdy piece of wood, and I think we got quite a challenge on there. But let's give it a go.
According to Caesar's book on the Gallic War, the Pelum was able to punch through several of their adversaries' shields. But can this actually be true? Or is Caesar wildly exaggerating?
Look at that. It's just punched straight through. It was just effortless almost. It was using his momentum against him. This broad conical head has punched through, and then this narrow foreshaft, because it's narrower than that, there was virtually no friction against it, so it just came straight through.
This also explains why the Romans put so much work into forging the head of the pilum and the long iron shaft. This is what allows a spear to penetrate the enemy's shield effortlessly. But could the adversary have pulled the pilum out and thrown it back at them?
I mean, if I was holding that, it would have reached the man behind. But even if it had only gone through that far, then it would have done this. You can see how the weight of this is pulling down. If I try to charge forward, now look what happens. My shield gets stuck. I can't pull it out. So all I do is abandon the shield. Now I have to continue my attack defenseless.
The Battle of Lutetia will be a bloodbath, but the Romans score a pivotal victory. It's another step on their way to conquer Gaul. Like many times in the history of war, discipline and technological supremacy are decisive.
The idea of the pilum, that it's a one-shot weapon, that you can only throw it once. Once it's hit the target, it's bent, you can't use it again. Of course, that means you can't throw it back at the Romans, but after the battle, the Romans will have won, they'll pick up all the pilum, they'll take them to the armorer, they'll mend them, and they'll be ready to use another day. So this is a very neat weapon.
The pilum is much more potent than an ordinary javelin. Effortlessly, it transfixes the shields of enemies and, at the same time, becomes useless for them. A master stroke by Roman weapon designers. After the fall of Rome, the pilum fades into oblivion. In order to successfully use this ranged weapon, you need a veritable arms industry. No early medieval kingdom has such capacities. Our next ranged weapon, the longbow. In the Middle Ages, it becomes the fear of all knights. What is its secret? And why were the English longbow archers dreaded by so many on the battlefield? 26th of August, 1346, Crecy, a small town near the Norman coast. The forces of England's King Edward III are facing those of his French antagonist, Philip VI. It is the first big battle of the Hundred Years' War between England and France. They fight over French mainland territory and the rule of France. England even claims the French throne. On paper, Philip's troops are clearly superior. 30,000 French warriors are ready to take down only 14,000 Englishmen. The French, however, have overestimated their chances of an easy victory. Thousands of English arrows rain down on them. Historians estimate that the English shot up to 35,000 arrows a minute. People have used bow and arrow for at least 10,000 years. But why does this ancient weapon become so crucial again in the Middle Ages? Bowyer Anton Weininger knows their mysteries.
This here is an English longbow, a U-bow. It stands out for its length and penetrating power. This weapon is enormously effective, even at longer distances. What fascinates me the most is that this is a piece of wood that is able to transport arrows incredibly far.
The dreaded Hungarian riders a few centuries earlier used shorter bows. These consist of several layers, a lengthy manufacturing process. Such composite bows are hardly weather-resistant, but they are handy for rapid deployment. However, the penetrating power of Hungarian composite bows is limited. In 955, the attackers lose against the armed forces of German King Otto. The English longbow is special because it consists of one single piece of wood, one trunk. Anton Weninger explores the historical techniques that our ancestors employed to make this weapon.
When you look at this yew, you can see the sapwood very well. That's the pale-colored layer. And this is the heartwood. The heart of the yew is very tough and durable, while the sapwood is very flexible and elastic. In yew bows, the belly, the part that faces the archer, is made of core wood, and the sap is used for the front side of the bow. There is a lot of tension when shooting, so this part needs to be bendy.
Yew wood grows extremely slowly, which makes it perfect for bowyery. This resistant wood is hard to get nowadays. One trunk costs about 200 euros. In the Middle Ages, the English bowery industry almost wipes out the entire European yew population with its insatiable demand for the wooden raw material. The timber for English longbows often comes from southern Germany. In the middle of the 16th century, there is hardly any yew left in the woods of Bavaria. The clear cutting has left a lasting mark. In Germany, yew is an endangered species.
Throughout history, men have treated nature quite carelessly when it comes to procuring resources for the production of weapons. Just look at Mitterberg in central Austria. In the Bronze Age, people mined copper ore in this region. The area around some of the mine tailings is still completely dead today.
Raw materials have always been essential for manufacturing weapons. The Romans needed 30 tons of iron to equip one single legion for battle. Since antiquity, mining and smelting for the weapons industry have contaminated European rivers. Air pollution even presented a problem in ancient Rome. Hundreds of furnaces produced toxic emissions generated during the smelting of copper, iron, or lead ore. Raw materials that were largely used to produce weapons.
You always work with what you've got. If you can pick it up, it's better than having to pay for it. And if you have control, and the King of England, for example, has ownership of everything under the ground. So anything you mine belongs to the King of England. So if you need iron, when it's dug up, the King owns it, and he'll pay you a fee for digging it out rather than paying you to actually own the physical property. So medieval and modern states have found ways of concentrating their resources to maximize their ability to manufacture weapons.
Back to the longbow. In his studio in Austria, Weninger is working on the fine tuning of the bow, which has taken its characteristic round form by now. The grooves at the ends will hold the string that Weninger will manufacture next. The string is a decisive detail for the performance of the longbow. The more robust it is, the further and more precisely the bow will shoot.
Traditionally, you used nettles or flax strings, but they don't grow as well as they used to anymore. Back in the Middle Ages, nettles could grow as high as 1.5 meters. For safety reasons, we use a nylon string. This also protects the bow from the vibrations, and we can be sure that the string won't break.
Medieval bowstrings made of natural materials easily lose their tension when they get wet and have to be replaced more frequently. The last step of the procedure is the most difficult one. Anton Weniger scrapes off razor-thin layers to influence the draw weight of the bow. The more he scrapes off, the lighter it will be. The medieval longbow, made of yew wood, almost 2 meters long. Draw weight, about 140 pounds. Today's competitive target shooters work with 30 to 50 pounds. The continued training with these massive weapons comes at a high price for the English longbow shooters.
This archer has a really large and oversized bow, and most of the archers suffered from skeletal lesions. On the left, that is the bow hand, they had underdeveloped shoulders. And on the right, where the draw hand is, the shoulder was overdeveloped. This is something archaeologists found in skeletons. You know immediately if someone was an archer or not.
On the battlefield, a well-trained medieval archer has one main tactical task: to break through the closed ranks of the enemy with targeted long-range shots. But how well does this work with a historical yew bow? The first shooting test at 50 meters, a normal distance in competitions today. Different factors affect the trajectory of the arrows, the crosswind, and the vibrations when the arrow is shot.
You always create tension in a bow by pulling back the string. Energy is stored in it due to this tension. And once I release the string, this potential energy becomes kinetic energy. But the moment I release the string, it starts to vibrate. Just think of it like a guitar string. And this vibration expands to the bow. And if I don't pay close attention and hold on tight to the front part, I will get a little shock and I might miss my target.
Weniger is an experienced archer. He has to keep all these factors in mind and intuitively anticipate the trajectory.
Five out of 10 arrows hit the target from a 50-meter range. I'm actually quite satisfied.
Medieval archers were not only known for their precision, but also for their high fire rate. How many arrows a minute are possible? Sticking the arrows in the ground in front of the archer is one technique that facilitates fast shooting. For this experiment, Anton Weniger puts on a gambeson, a historical piece of padded armor that the archers at Crecy wore as well.
Ready, steady, go.
I can't believe it.
An unusual situation. The medieval armor seems to greatly restrict Weniger's movements.
And what was my time?
59:35.
Okay, almost. But it's really not easy with this thing on. It's really heavy, very stiff. I could only draw the first one downwards. I just could not lift my arm. The arrows are all over the place. That's bad. And incredibly hard.
Some modern archers train intensely for fast shooting. They can fire an arrow every 1 or 2 seconds. Ancient sources also mention special techniques, like holding several arrows in one hand. The longbow is a significant part of England's medieval culture. King Edward III issued a decree in 1369 that obliged Londoners to regularly practice archery.
Even 6-year-old children were drilled to learn how to shoot a bow. Most of the archers didn't get any older than 25, so that was their expiration date, if you will. Young people were almost abused in this desire to produce good archers.
The well-trained archers also represent a threat to the feudal order.
This is a terrifying weapon for two reasons. One, it'll kill you, but more importantly, it means that peasants can kill noblemen. It's changed the natural order of things. Noblemen in armor should be able to knock over all the peasants. Now one peasant with a longbow can kill the nobleman. So this terrifies an aristocratic order that believes that it has superiority because of birth, because of privilege, and because it has the money for a horse and some armor. So it's a leveling weapon. It takes away the advantage of privilege and it restores it to the advantage of skill and practice.
This also explains why archers are surrounded by myths. The most popular among them lives in the forest, Robin Hood. In the first medieval ballads, he is described as a highwayman, an ordinary criminal. But later, in 16th century literature, he becomes an almost altruistic robber leader who takes from the rich and gives to the poor. He went down in history as a highly skilled longbow archer. His story remains fascinating to this day. Countless movies celebrate the heroic Robin Hood.
It's a most unlikely story. Villains don't give money to the poor, they just take it from the rich. But he's a folk hero who's invented at a time when the king is oppressing the peasants and taxing them heavily. So the idea that some mythic figure would arise and take the money back that the king has stolen and give it to the people who it belongs to. It's the myth of all myths because every country has a figure like this. In England, he's Robin Hood. He dresses in green to hide in the forest and he uses a longbow against the king's men who wear armor and carry swords. So he's leveling the playing field. He's a working class hero.
English longbow archers pose a threat to noblemen in real life too, with arrow salves shot from far away. How does such a long-range shot work? Anton Weninger will now test his U-bow on a distance of 100 meters. He has to shoot high.
I have to aim far above the target up in the forest. That is where my target is now, and this is where I want to get up to. The distance is okay, but the wind is giving me a hard time today. Now I calculate it with the wind, the direction should be perfect.
At this distance, an archer faces many problems. Weninger needs to inch towards the target.
We're not far off.
All his arrows fall near the target, where they dig deep into the ground. Such long-range shots in a high curve develop an enormous force and would have penetrated the armor of fast-approaching knights.
The English longbows were even stronger than this bow, you know? This one is at 50 pounds. Back in the days, they were at 100 to 120 pounds. Their trajectory is lower, they did not have to aim as high as I just did, and the arrows were heavier. That means there was less drift in the wind.
We want to find out how bad the injuries caused by an arrow are. Weninger is setting up a torso made of ballistic gelatine. For the targeted shot, he gets assistance from trick shot artist Peter Stecher. The arrow shot from a 30-meter distance enters deep into the ballistic gelatine. The material closely simulates the characteristics of human tissue and shows how fatally longbows could injure a man.
What? 10 centimeters, that's very deep.
Let's see how deep that is.
Right in the heart.
This also explains the outcome of the Battle of Crecy. Several thousands dead in the French ranks, while the English only lost a couple of hundred men. This defeat will weaken the Kingdom of France for decades. Once again, sophisticated technology has given the decisive edge.
The longbow is not a precision instrument. It's not designed to hit a single man at long range. It's designed to engage a large body of men and almost certainly horses as well, moving towards the longbowman and they will fire volleys of arrows at the great mass of the enemy. So it's about a very large amount of fire. So it's quite modern.
The longbow, a decisive weapon in late medieval battles. After years of training, the English archers can defeat the French knights. Other European rulers would like to have troops with such penetration power, but only the English king invests enough money and time to build an efficient army of archers. But as time goes by, the longbow quickly loses impact. At the end of the Middle Ages, new weapons arise, bringing noise and smoke, and a more efficient form of ranged warfare. Fire weapons fundamentally change military technology around the globe. One of the deadliest inventions of the 19th century, the miniball. It decides on life and death on the battlefield, and also sparks significant progress in medical care for soldiers. What's so special about this new kind of ammunition? Before the miniball, until the middle of the 19th century, combat tactics were simple. The soldiers moved in closed ranks towards one another and then shot at their enemies with muskets.
These weapons were quite powerful. They did a lot of damage if they hit a human body, but they were not accurate beyond about 50 paces, about 40 meters. And they tended to be fired not at targets, but they would be leveled as a platoon of soldiers would level their muskets towards the target and fire them all at once, hoping that some of the rounds would hit the target. Beyond 100 yards, you would make a lot of noise. You might hit a few things and you might frighten the horses, but that's about it. So this is a weapon which lacks range.
The mini ball will end this kind of warfare forever. Summer 1853. Russian troops invade the Ottoman Empire. The Crimean War begins, the first media war in history. Photographer Robert Fenton has a mobile development lab. His photos document the everyday life of the soldiers. Telegraph lines spread the news everywhere on the continent within the blink of an eye. France and England fight side by side with the Ottoman Empire. In the Battle of Inkerman on the 5th of November 1854, they use the new miniball against the Russian troops and score an important triumph. On a firing range near Gotha in central Germany, we want to uncover the secret behind the miniball and find out how it could make the round lead balls obsolete so quickly. The whole different form of this new type of ammunition immediately catches the eye. Wolfgang Staber trades in historical weapons. He knows how deeply the new ammunition affected the wars of the 19th century.
The miniball has transformed history because it was manufactured in a way that allowed much higher precision.
In 1846, French officer Claude-Étienne Minier invents the revolutionary ball, which requires a special barrel. The miniball is not round, which was the norm before, but is conical at the front. It's not even 3 centimeters long and only weighs 32 grams. A tiny projectile with dramatic effects.
Minier designed the ball in such a way that it became the basis for all modern bullets.
But what made Minier's ammunition that much better than the existing lead balls? Our shooting experiment begins at a distance of 50 meters.
I'll shoot 10 times and see how significant the dispersion is.
Staber first puts in the gunpowder and then the round lead ball wrapped in wadding, which seals the gas behind the projectile in the barrel. He uses a Brown Bess for the experiment, a standard musket of the British Army in the 18th century.
You can hit the target, but there is some significant dispersion.
The Brown Bess has a flintlock mechanism which creates a spark that ignites the gunpowder, which then in turn ignites the main charge in the barrel. Two ignitions in a row. But the technology is prone to malfunction.
That's typical for flintlock weapons. The ignition often fails. The gunpowder makes everything messy. And the flint, that's here, stops emitting sparks at some point, and you have to replace it. They often malfunction.
The firing experiment continues with a new flint and new ignition charge. And the musket causes more problems.
I can barely touch it. It's getting hotter and hotter. It's getting harder to charge because the barrel is increasingly blocked. It needs to be cleaned thoroughly. All right, let's try and fire the last shot.
Stauber's last shot also misses the target.
I think it's astonishing that you can hit this target at all. 8 shots hit it, 2 missed. But you can already see how much dispersion there is. That's why the musket has no fixed sight. From a military point of view, it was like a scattershot. They passed the firing line, said fire, hoping that someone would hit the target.
Now the mini ball. It needs to be greased before charging. Otherwise, it would scratch along inside the barrel and leave lead traces. The thick layer of grease in the characteristic grooves of the projectile prevents this. To match the ammunition, Stauber uses an Enfield rifle that was introduced to the English Army in 1852.
The mini ball is easier to charge than the round ball with the wadding.
And targeting is much easier too, because other than the musket, the Enfield rifle has sights.
They're much closer together. It's clearly more accurate.
While hitting the target with the musket is a matter of luck, Stauber shoots more accurately using the mini balls.
You can clearly see that the mini ball is superior. All these shots would have been deadly.
The evaluation shows, using the new projectile, Stauber hits the target 7 times out of 10, perfectly or almost perfectly. He can only score 3 hits with a lead ball. The other shots are widely dispersed. The mini ball was designed to hit a target from a distance of several hundred meters. This is only possible in combination with another invention.
The mini ball was not the only innovation. The barrel is also part of the new design.
The rifle barrel was invented long before the mini ball, presumably in the late 15th century. The idea was that the grooves machined into the walls impart spin to the projectile. The spinning motion stabilizes the trajectory. There are different ways of manufacturing rifle barrels. Historically, the grooves were cut in a complicated process. Today, they are usually formed with a hammer.
It's delicate work requiring a lot of attention to detail. These barrels are high-precision instruments.
This is how the mechanism works. The explosion of the gunpowder generates a gas cloud, which drives the projectile forward. Minier's ball has a conical hollow in its base, which expands under the pressure of the explosion and seals the barrel perfectly. Due to the spiral grooves, the bullet starts spinning.
The stronger the spin, the bigger an external force must be to diverge the trajectory of the projectile. This means the spin ensures a stable trajectory. And if you were to shoot these bullets without spin, the distribution of the mass would be so imbalanced that the mini ball would just tumble and flip over.
Military officers worked meticulously on the sophistication of ammunition long before Minier. The objective was always to increase accuracy and range, and most importantly, the firing rate per minute. As early as the 16th century, musketeers started using specially designed small wooden tubes that were filled with the exact amount of powder charge they required. In the 17th century, the first paper cartridges were invented that further facilitated the charging process. In just one case, they contained the gunpowder and the lead projectile. The next leap forward was the integration of all components in one metal cartridge. A couple of French gunsmiths were successful in this endeavor, the first being Casimir Le Faucheur with his pinfire cartridge. The second, weapon inventor Louis Flaubert. These cartridges almost look like modern ammunition.
The metal cartridge was a crucial advance in the development of firearms because the cartridge brought together the four elements in one place. It contained the bullet or projectile. It contained the main charge, which launched the projectile. It contained the cap, which initiated the main charge. And finally, the case itself.
100 years ago, John Moses Browning, an American firearms designer, developed ammunition with a large cartridge and a slim pointed projectile. To this day, the design has barely changed. But the way ammunition is manufactured influences its effect. Some projectiles have such disastrous effects on the human body that they have been internationally outlawed.
What I'd like to know now is how powerful this mini ball is compared to a round ball and the modern NATO cartridge. I'll shoot at this ballistic block. It's a very special gel. It shows me the real impact of a bullet on a human body.
Each type of ammunition needs the right rifle. For the lead bullet, Staber uses the old musket. The bullet goes straight through the ballistic block and exits again at the back. For the NATO cartridge, Staber uses a semi-automatic rifle. The cartridge itself has been an integral part of the standard equipment of Western armies for almost 50 years. Same thing here, a perforating shot. In the last round, Wolfgang Staber uses a mini ball to shoot at the ballistic dummy. The projectile that dates back more than 150 years has the biggest impact energy.
Down here was the round ball, the biggest and heaviest bullet we have. Incredible impact. That's easy to see. A large wound channel. The smallest bullet, the NATO cartridge, just darted through it. So brutally, it would have perforated anybody. The mini ball was actually the most effective. It's the one that displaced most tissue. You could see the enormous impact energy. It actually quite scares me that this ancient mini ball has had such an impact.
A direct comparison. On the left, the lead bullet. On the right, the NATO cartridge. In the middle, the mini ball with powerful effect.
If you look closely at a bullet wound, you can see a large area where the tissue has been destroyed. This was also true if the bullet hit a bone. It was simply splintered. That means the wounds were really, really big. The bones within were splintered. And in the past, it was extremely difficult to do anything, to operate, for example.
The wounds inflicted by the new bullet have far-reaching consequences. The Battle of Solferino takes place in the Second Italian War of Independence in 1859. Austria fights the Italians and the French. Swiss businessman Henri Dunant witnesses the terrible wounds the mini ball causes. Almost 40,000 dead and wounded people lie on the battleground. Spontaneously and together with volunteers, Dunant organizes makeshift first aid for the wounded. It's the beginning of a movement that will soon become known as the Red Cross. From 1864 on, a predecessor of the German Red Cross is employed for the first time in the wars of German unification. The 19th century is marked by discussions about how to make wars more human, focusing on helping the wounded and setting up binding rules for warfare. In 1899, the major powers agree on the Hague Convention. Amongst other things, it prohibits the use of weapons that cause unnecessary suffering. A milestone on the way to humanitarian international law, its impact, however, remains limited.
The ultimate answer to the Hague Convention was that everybody broke it in the First World War, some more than others. And they broke it because the alternative was to be defeated. And rules are rules, but when you're up against it, the opportunity to cheat a little is quite attractive. It's a very human thing.
Only after millions have died in the two world wars do people start to rethink. The societies of the 21st century are no longer willing to sacrifice entire generations of young soldiers. States have become increasingly interested in ranged weapons which minimize the danger for their soldiers.
There's a temptation to think that we can sanitize warfare, that we can make it such a one-sided process that it looks remarkably like a video game. We sit at a long distance, press some buttons, and the bad guys go away. That isn't the game the bad guys want to play. We have to accept that distance is a great advantage, precision is a great advantage, but battles are won ultimately when the enemy is defeated. And if he won't come out to play, you will have to go and get him. And that means getting closer and closer and closer to the place where he wants you to be.
Nevertheless, much effort and money is put into the development of new ranged weapons. Sometimes they look like they come straight from a science fiction movie. For example, the railgun. But the US Navy is indeed testing it. The first phase is stationary, but the long-term goal is to operate the weapon from ships or ground vehicles. The patent for the railgun was filed in 1918, but it took almost 100 years for this technology to be ready to use.
In railguns, propellants become completely redundant because the acceleration is caused by a magnetic field, not by an explosion. The principle behind railguns comes from physics and functions like this. I have a conductor, like a piece of wire, through which electricity is running. In addition, there is an external magnetic field that affects the wire. This creates a force that wants to move the conductor. Now, if you take a railgun, you don't have a wire, but you send the current right down the projectile. And if I now have a strong external magnetic field, there's an accelerating force impact on the projectile that is so powerful that it can generate a velocity 7 times the speed of sound.
This novel technology breaks all limitations of conventional fire weapons. For physical reasons, they cannot eject a projectile faster than 2 kilometers per second. The railgun, on the other hand, fires almost 4 times as fast. Today, it can accurately hit a target that is 185 kilometers away. It was a long way until this futuristic weapon was born. The first ranged weapons, like the javelin, were used at close range of a couple of meters. Over the centuries, the battle distance has gradually increased. In a test setting, the railgun projectile effortlessly penetrates several steel plates. But it has a downside. It uses a lot of power to generate the enormous projectile velocity. Whether the railgun will really change future wars remains to be seen.